to John chapter 12. And don't worry about turning your Bibles yet there, because I'm going to let you follow along with me on the screen. And we're going to read this together. And I want you to read the part that the crowd would have been saying at that point. Hosanna, blessed is he. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And say it like you're there. So would you stand with me? And I'll read, and then you can respond. God's Word says in John 12:12, the next day, the great crowd that had come for the feast heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, Jesus found a young donkey and sat upon it, as it is written. At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him, and that they had done these things to him. Now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead, continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had given this miraculous sign, they went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. Look, the whole world has gone after him." Now is the time. Those words are words that I loved when I was a child. And I can remember 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I didn't love the timing of those words. But 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, when my mom or dad would come in and wake me up and, Gary, now's the time. And we'd get up and we would travel on our vacation as a family, go to the mountains, go to the beach, whatever. Also, I think of that concept, now is the time of having my hands in the huddle, and all the guys are gathered around, and the coach is saying, guys, now's the time. And we break the huddle and run out onto the field and play the championship baseball game. Probably the best memory of that concept, though, of now is the time, was standing in the back hallway of the church and the pastor walking up to me and saying, Gary, now's the time. And I walked out and saw my bride coming down the aisle. Now's the time. I loved those words. But there's also a time when I detested hearing those words. Like just before I slithered into the dentist chair. Now's the time. Or much worse, if you can imagine, much worse than a dentist chair. Dave Anderson, I apologize if you're in this service. I like you, just not the chair. But what about the horridness of the person who's about to be strapped into the electric chair? Now's the time. Why do I bring this up? Because as we look to John's Gospel, and we're going to be in John chapter 13, if you'd like to turn there this morning. And the passages we'll specifically look at, we'll start at verse 31 and go through verse 4 of chapter 14. I believe it's 1674, if you'd like to use one of our church Bibles. But all through John, there's this running theme that begins with the first miracle. In chapter 2 of John, Jesus is at this wedding feast and they run out of wine. And so his mother comes to him. Well, certainly he can fix it. And she wants him to fix the problem. Anybody remember his response? He said, My time hasn't come yet. My time hasn't come yet. Oh, he still fixed the problem. He turned water into wine. It's the first recorded miracle that we have. But it started this theme of this time. What was this time that was to come? And as you keep on reading through the book of John, you'll get to chapter 7. And in chapter 7, there are these people who are not believing that these miracles that Jesus is doing is any proof that He is the Christ, that He is the Son of God. They're not believing His words and who He is that are proving that He is the Christ, the Son of God. And they don't understand that by believing in Him, that they would have life and have life in His name. And so right there in John chapter 7, there's this group who are yet to believe, and they try to seize Him. Anybody would say that I'm the anointed one. I'm the Messiah. I'm the Christ. I'm the one you've been waiting for. I'm the Son of God. Literally, I'm God. They thought this guy needs to be put to death. And so they tried to seize Him there in John chapter 7. And if you look back and read that, you find out that they couldn't. They didn't. Why? And John's very clear. Because His time had not yet come. And so you keep reading, and when is this time going to come? And then when we get to chapter 12, and we read what we read together a moment ago, this triumphal entry with Jesus coming in with the palm branches, we find out that His time had come. That this is the time. If you want to flip back, if you're in 13, flip back to chapter 12 for just a moment, and look at verse 23 of John chapter 12. Just after he's ridden in the triumphal entry we read a moment ago, then verse 23, Jesus says, "The hour," or the time, "has come. The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Wow, they're thinking it's come. He's going to be glorified. But then He starts talking about death. And He starts talking about how he's troubled deep into His soul. Look at verse 27 of that same chapter. Jesus says, "Now my heart is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Save me from this time." No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify Your name. And then if you turn the page, see in chapter 13, it's just before the Passover feast. What does Jesus know is happening? Jesus knows that His time has come. And then look down to verse 30. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, now remember, they're together for the Passover. The time had come. It's just before the Passover feast. He knows it's His time. He's already said that there would be one to betray Him. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, Judas goes out. And the Bible says it was night. It was dark. It wasn't just physically dark. It was dark in his heart. It was dark. It was a dark time. And in this darkness, we see that the time has come. This is the time. In the midst of darkness, Judas has set the train of events leading to the cross in motion. 31. When Judas had gone, Jesus says, "Now," again, "now is the time. Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in Him. If God is glorified in Him, God will glorify the Son in Himself and will glorify Him at once." What's happening here is, again, Jesus is with all the disciples. They're in this upper room together. Thus, you hear this many times referred to as the upper room discourse, or you hear it referred to as the farewell discourse, because He's talking to them just before He goes to the cross. And so these are the last words before He goes to the cross, and Judas has gone out. And He's saying, it's a time for glory. It's a time for glory. It's coming to climax. Now's the time. What we've been reading up, what we've been learning, all this comes to climax. And the time of glory is actually in the shame of the cross. That's what He's saying. See, he's doing something beautiful here for us, actually, John is, because he's letting us look down into that room. They weren't getting it. But he points the camera angle from a heavenly angle, if you will. And so we get to see what's really happening. What's really happening when He talks about glory. Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in Him. What He's saying is He, the Son of Man, is actually glorified in the cross. And even the Father is also glorified in the cross. Then He says, if God is glorified in Him, God will glorify the Son in Himself. Jesus is glorified in the cross. The Father is glorified in the cross. And he goes on to say that the Father will then glorify the Son in raising him from the dead and exalting him back to his proper place of glory that he left to come and humble himself as a man. And he said, this is going to happen now. This is going to happen at once, and will glorify him at once. And one commentator says it like this, says that God is glorified in Jesus' temporal obedience, sacrifice, death, resurrection, and exaltation, one event. His temporal obedience, his sacrifice, his death, his resurrection and exaltation, we need to see as one. See as one in the God's plan of redeeming his people as one event. And what's happening here, it is key to, of the timing, I should say. Now is the time. This is about to happen at once. This is happening now. Now Jesus is going away. But now you can't come, he goes on to say. Look at verse 33. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You'll look for me. And just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now. Where I'm going, you cannot come. He's going now. You cannot come now. What do you think Peter has to say about that? Simon Peter asked him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus tells him. Peter says, verse 37, Lord, why can't I follow you now? Is he really asking that question? I don't think so. I think he's making a statement in question form. Lord, why can't I follow you now? I'm going to follow you now. I mean, look what he follows it up with. I will lay down my life for you. I'm going to do this. It's interesting. Peter hasn't gotten it yet. I'll lay down my life for you. But he couldn't lay down his life for Jesus until Jesus had laid down his life for Peter. And so Peter's getting the timing all mixed up. I'm ready to do it now. No, you can't do it now, but look back to verse 36. After he'd asked him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus had said, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow later. There will be a time. You can follow later. And then as we look on, look at verse 3 of chapter 14. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. So Jesus is saying, I'm going. You can't come now. I've got to do this. But you can come later. As a matter of fact, I'm going to come back and get you. And you're going to be able to go with me later. So what's our part then? What do we do with that? What did he say for the disciples to do with that? Well, here's what he said. Verse 1 of chapter 14. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Yeah, that's easy. I'm about to die. But don't worry about it. Don't let your hearts be troubled. But he goes on to say, don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust. Trust in God. Trust also in me. Because trusting in God is trusting in the Son. Trusting in the Son is trusting in the Father. He says, trust me. Trust me. Or follow me. It's the same thing here. Follow me. So who follows? Who is it that follows Jesus then? Well, as we look at this, nobody at first. What do you mean, Pastor, nobody at first? Well, look at this, verse 33. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me. And just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. You can't even follow me right now. What was he saying? Why couldn't they follow him right now? Because only Jesus could accomplish the work of redemption. Only Jesus could accomplish the work of salvation. Only Jesus could go to the cross to pay for this penalty of sin, to satisfy the very wrath of God. Only Jesus could do this. Peter couldn't lay his life down for Jesus. Jesus had to lay his life down for Peter. Then Peter could lay his life down for Jesus. Now, they had heard this before. Matter of fact, Jesus told them that. You'll look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now. Because you've heard it before. But they don't always remember that, do they? As a matter of fact, listen to this. I'm going to read from chapter 8 in the same book of John, verse 21. Listen to the similarity of what he had already told this group. Now, as I read this, picture in your mind, he's not talking to the disciples back in chapter 8. He's talking to people who don't believe that He's the Christ, who don't believe that He's God's Son, who haven't gotten it yet. And He tells them, I'm going away, and you will look for Me. Wait a minute, these people are looking for Him just like His followers. Yeah. But He says, and you will die in your sin. Where I go, you cannot come. Back in chapter 13, remember He says, you will look for Me, and where I'm going, you cannot come. There's a huge omission there, isn't there? He doesn't tell His followers that you will die in your sin. But He told these who didn't believe in Him that they would die in their sin. What's that all about? Well, that's all about the good news, isn't it? But He's saying, if you believe, if you follow, if you trust Me in this work that I'm about to do for you on the cross, that you can come later. You can't come now, but you can come later. And if you don't, He said, the sin that I died for, if you don't turn your life to Me, if you don't trust in Me, then you know what? You'll die in your sin. But you don't have to. There's hope for anyone, for everyone who follows Him. So then what's expected? What's expected of those who are following Jesus? Look at verse 34, back in 13. He says, a new command I give you. Wow, okay, He's about to go, but He's going to give us this new command. I want to listen to this. I want to focus on this. He's going to give me a new command. This is going to be great. I want to listen to this. Here's the new command. Love one another. You say, wait a minute. You know, that's not so new. Love one another. I mean, that for hundreds of years, we look all back through the rest of the Bible and we see this, love one another, love one another. Deuteronomy 6, Leviticus 19, if you want to look at some exact passages with this concept, loving one another. But He said now it's a new command. And we've been told that all along. I've been reading the Old Testament. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. I know that. He says, no, it's a new command. And here's the new part. Here's the fresh part. Keep reading. Love one another. How? As I have loved you. Here's the new part. Here's the fresh part. That Jesus is saying, watch Me. I'm the standard. I'm the supreme example here. Just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. And by this, all men will know that you are My disciples if you love one another. It's interesting what He doesn't say here in verse 35. He doesn't say, by this loving of one another, you will be My disciples, does He? He doesn't say you become His follower by loving one another. No, He says as a result of following Him. Result of being in His family is our love for one another. And then as we love one another, then He says, hey, other people are going to notice that. Other people are going to see that. And by this, all people will know that you're My disciples if you have this love for one another. What does this look like? Well, look at verse 1 of chapter 13. The second part of the verse says, having loved His own, speaking of Jesus, of course, having loved Jesus' own who were in the world, He now showed them the full extent of His love. And of course, ultimately the full extent of His love is going to the cross, right? But before He even talks about the cross, we see here how they're having this meal together. And they're about to have the Passover meal, take the cup and the bread. And while they're having this meal together, they've come into this upper room and you can just imagine they've been walking on these dusty roads and their feet are nasty. And no one's cleaned their feet. And in this culture, there's supposed to be some servants that are supposed to take care of that stuff. But they haven't been cleaned yet. And so who stops to wash each other's feet? But Jesus. And He says, hey, here's the example to follow. But in that culture, a peer wasn't even supposed to wash another peer's feet, much less the teacher and the student, the master and his follower. And He says, this is what it looks like. It's humble service first and foremost. It's giving up your pride. It's giving up yourself to serve each other. I had someone I respect greatly tell me, he said, Gary, help me think through what happened at our church service this day. And he said, we were in the time together and the pastor called up the leaders of the church. And he had them all sit up on the platform, and he had this basin of water. And he had a towel, and he had all of them take off their shoes and socks and just started washing their feet and saying, this is what Jesus did. What do you think about that, Gary? My first response was, you know, if he would have sneaked out into the parking lot and washed all their cars, that would have probably been a better example of what Jesus was talking about of serving his disciples, wouldn't it? Or if they had known about some things that you have done, for example, when Mark Staples, our youth pastor, I think it was last year on the missions trip when you guys were gone, and I think it was like a couple of dozen of you just went over and painted his house for him and got it ready for when he returned. And several of you did the same thing for me before I ever came. And some of you, I don't even know who you were. I mean, humble to the point of didn't even say anything, but before Paige and I moved here, you came and you painted the inside of our house. You know what Mark and Candace's neighbors and Paige and my neighbors thought about that? They thought, I'd like to know who these people are. I'd like to be part of something like that. I think that may be getting a little closer, don't you, to what he's talking about of serving one another. Of serving one another, not because this is going to make us holy and God's going to smile upon us, because that's who we are. Because Christ is in us and he says, this is me working in and through you. This is what love is, not just telling each other, but action. You know, Peter didn't want Jesus to wash his feet, did he? I mean, it's the same kind of thing we saw when he said he would go to the cross. He would, or didn't say about the cross, but he would die for Jesus. He also, oh, Jesus, you can't wash my feet. Let me do this to you. But it's humbling, too, for the Master, for us to say, God, you've got to do something in and through me first. And it's the humility for the one being served as well, isn't it? But also, who else was at that table? Judas was there too, wasn't he? So Judas, the enemy of God, got his feet washed too. You know, it's a little easier for me to take care of somebody and that I know I love them and they love me. But what if they don't like me very much? And I don't like them very much. As a matter of fact, they don't even want me in this church. Or whatever it may be. You know, that's the example that he gave of serving, of loving. Of to go to those people. A few weeks ago, I told you about a family issue that we had in my family back in Louisiana. We gathered together and just praying and seeking God's help and reading the scriptures together. And one of my older brothers, he kept the whole week going back to this one scripture. And when he first started reading it, I was like, many of you may be when I start reading it, okay, I've memorized that when I was a kid, or at least I've heard it a lot. But by the end of the week, it just became so real, so powerful. It was 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I'm nothing. If not love, it's nothing. I mean, if I could take, you know, the Bible and trace from Adam to Eve to the present and know exactly how all the end times things are coming out and have my little chart for you, but overlook somebody in trouble. And not willing to walk into a messy relationship and take care of one another. He says, hey, it just doesn't mean much. Love is patient. Love is kind. It doesn't envy, does not boast, is not proud. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. And this last one is the one that we camped on. I don't think we got past this verse. This last phrase here. It keeps no record of wrongs. Humble service. Love. He showed the extent of His love. And of course, the full extent was humble sacrifice. But He said, no, I don't want you to die. Let me go. I want to take your place for you. You can't come. You can't do this now. But I can do it. And let me be the pioneer. Let me be the author of your faith. Let me go there for you. And He went to the cross and died. And He says, this is the full extent. Here's the full extent of love. A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this all men will know that you're my disciples. If you love one another. Now you can just imagine the disciples wanting to just tear into that and ask Him all these questions about what do you mean about this love and service, Jesus, and what does this look like, and help me with this. And so we read on to see how they just dug into this. So Peter speaks up. Lord, where are you going? Wait a minute, Peter. Aren't you going to spend a moment on this new command? aren't you going to look at it for just a moment? That's a logical question. He's going. They want to ask Him where we're going. But it goes back again to, I can trace out history and the future from the Bible. But do we find ourselves like Peter? I'm more concerned about the plan and the strategy than I am about love and obedience. It's not the wrong question. But there's something overlooked here, huge, I believe. Jesus, in His graciousness as always, he answers the question, though. Jesus replied, where I'm going, you cannot follow now. But you will follow later. Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. I'll do it for you. No, you can't. You can't do that. And Jesus' answer must have shocked Peter. I think it was shocking for him to hear this. Because do you think Peter thought he would really lay down his life for Jesus? I think he did. I think there was no doubt in his mind, I can do this thing. And I'm going to do this thing. Remember Peter. This is the man of faith. He's the one that got out of the boat. Started walking on the water. This is the man who's bold. Matthew 14. He actually rebuked Jesus. Come on, Peter. This is the Peter who earlier in John chapter 6, when all these people started walking away from Jesus and Jesus said, hey, are you going with them? And Peter's the one who stands up and says, where would we go? No, I'm all in. We're all in. We're following you, Jesus. We're with you. You're the Son of God. So I think he was shocked when Jesus answered and said, will you really lay down your life for me? And I can just see Peter wanting to interrupt. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Jesus, no, no. Will you really lay down your life for me? Peter, I tell you the truth. Here's the truth. Before the rooster crows, you'll disown me three times. And I don't think he still believed it until he did it. Until he had to eat about three more humble pies here. And to realize, you know, I can't stand up and sing. I've decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. Until I'm humbled to the point to where I realize, no, I can't follow Jesus. But He can help me. And then I can follow Him. It wasn't until he was humbled that he could stand up and sing, yeah, I'm following now. I'm following all the way now. Our leader says he's about to leave. We can't follow now. Not even his number one student can follow right now. So what happens with everybody, with all the disciples? Well, Jesus knows what's happening to them. That's why he says in verse 1 of chapter 14, do not let your hearts be troubled. He sees it on their faces, doesn't he? He sees in their hearts. What does this mean? He says, don't let your hearts be troubled. Okay, I need help with that then, Jesus. Because my heart is troubled. And my heart gets troubled a lot. As a matter of fact, I've seen your heart troubled, Jesus. I mean, can you see them? You know, back we just read in 12:27 that his own heart was troubled. And he was saying, you know, and you find another place, he was saying, God, if it be your will, could you let this cup pass from me? I don't want to drink the cup of your wrath. I'd rather not, but if it's your will, I'll do it. And now he's telling them, and telling us, don't be troubled. So what's the prescription then for a troubled heart? Trust in God. Trust in me. Just keep on trusting. Oh, come on, is that the best? Wait a minute, keep on trusting? That's a little hollow, isn't it? How many of you find that? You know, somebody, you're going through some trouble and they say, just keep on trusting, keep on trusting. And you want to say, give me something else. Let me say this, though. It's not hollow. It's not trite if the one you are trusting is trustworthy. For example, let's say you're in a car crash. Your best friend is with you. You're driving down the road. You crash. And your best friend is just hurt incredibly to the point of almost being mangled. And you say, oh, I've got to get my friend help. And you're pretty close to me. And so you drive over, you drive your friend over to me and you say, here's the pastor. He'll help you. Pastor Gary, here's my friend. Can you help him? Just trust in Gary. Trust in Gary. That's pretty hollow, isn't it? Because I'm not going to be able to help him. I don't know what to do. But let's say you drive him over to Merrick Quorum. Dr. Merrick Quorum. And say, just trust him. He'll know what to do. It's not so hollow anymore, is it? Because you say, hey, here's somebody I can trust. It's not so hollow when you're trusting the one who has gone through the trouble for you, who has been troubled in his soul for you, and died on the cross, and said, I'm walking for you. I'm credible. I'm trustworthy. You can trust me. Trust in me, he says. Trust in God. Trust also in me. Trust in his person, in the person of Christ. It's not trusting in your trust. It's not even trusting in your ability to trust. But trusting in Christ and who he is. And as we go on reading, not only does he say, trust in me, the person of Christ. But he says, trust in my preparation for you. Trust in my preparation of a home for you. In my Father's house, there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. I like the way the NIV translates this, actually. In my Father's house are many rooms. Some of you say, well, Pastor, I've always learned that it's in my Father's house are many mansions. And I like that picture of a mansion. I like that picture of a mansion, too. And I think that's a good picture, but that's not what Jesus is really getting at here. Or that just a brief history lesson real quickly. Jerome had translated the New Testament into Latin in the 4th century A.D. And he had used the word here, M-A-N-S-I-O-N-E-S would be the word that in the NIV is rooms here. And as I spelled that, it's very close to our English word mansions, right? And so when the King James Version took the word into English, they use the word that was most closely related, mansions. And so, you know, when you sing the song, I don't even know the song. I shouldn't have started that. Where's Evan? He could help me with this. Anyway, about my home with many mansions. I mean, it's a good picture. But the real point of it is to say, this is a home. The Latin word meant a lodging place. A place for home. You find the same word in verse 23 of chapter 14, where Jesus says, if anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching. My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. Jesus says, trust in me. Trust in my preparation of a home for you. And I realize some of you too right now are saying, you know, Pastor, you just don't understand. I not only do I not have good memories of my father's house, but growing up in my father's house, I have some horrid memories. But I believe that especially you who have the worst memories may have the greatest longing for a real home and may understand this instinctively better than those of us who have had a great home here on earth. That there's a longing for this home with Him. There's a longing for something better. And Jesus has said, that's coming. Because I'm going to prepare it for you. Now, a few years ago, several years ago, I was back in Louisiana, and Paige and I and our children and all of our family had gathered there where my parents are, and we were worshiping on a Sunday with my parents. And after the worship time, one of my brothers said, hey, let's go back and see our old place where we all grew up. And so the four brothers, our families, my mom and dad, we all started going to the house. And I need to explain the house to you before I take you there. It was probably, it was a mansion. It was probably 10,000 square feet. And there was the house, you could run around in circles inside the house. I mean, like my house where I live now, you get to a point where you come to an end. But there, and I know that because my older brothers used to chase me. And I would run around in those circles, and I could get away from them, theoretically. And so we went to this house, and of course it was in Louisiana, and so you've seen since Hurricane Katrina hit that how, you know, the levees broke and stuff. Well, our house was right beside a levee and a river on the other side. And the levee, I mean, it must have been probably about half the size of Mount Hood. And so we drive to the house, and some of you know where I'm going with this now. And the levee, all of a sudden, I could skip up it in about 10 steps. It wasn't half the size of Mount Hood. And this 10,000 square foot mansion that I grew up in was only a few hundred square feet, actually. But all my memories, you know, of home were so grandiose, though, and then it was so tiny when I saw it. What's the point? The point is just flip that on its head. And as grand as your imagination can take you of what your home in heaven is like, your imagination is tiny compared to the grandness of what our home will be with God. And Jesus says, trust in me. Trust in my preparation of that home for you. And as we keep reading, and he says, and trust in my promise. And if I go and prepare a place for you, hey, if I'm going to do all this work for you, get it ready for you, I'll come back. I'll come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. Now's not the time, he told the disciples, to follow in the cross. But it's coming. There's a time I'm going to take you and you're going to be with me. Now, I think as the people of this culture, of this era, this time period, would have read this over and over, I think they would have, this picture would have come to mind at some point when reading this of a wedding, of a bride and a bridegroom. Why? Because in their culture, the father would have chosen a bride for his son. And having chosen the bride for his son, he would have sent the son out and he would have gone and he would have paid the bride price for his chosen bride. And then having paid that bride price, he would leave her there, and he'd go back to his father's house, and then he would make preparations, and he'd prepare his father's house for that day when he went to go get his bride. Now, certainly as that was true then, it's true now that our Father in heaven has chosen the bride price for the bride that he's chosen for his son. And he sent his son. And his son has come and he's paid the bride price, even death on a cross. And having paid the price, he rose from the dead, went back to his father's house. And he's saying, if I go and I prepare a place for you, you can be sure. You can be sure that I'm coming back for you. And that you're going to be with me where I am if you believe, if you're one of mine, if you're trusting in Him. He finally says, verse 4, you know the way to the place I'm going. You know the way. Thankfully, we have Thomas here. You know how you always have that one person in the classroom that asks a stupid question, and you're glad they asked a stupid question because you had that question on your mind, but you weren't going to ask it. And Thomas says, Lord, wait a minute. No, we don't. No, we don't. Jesus says, yes, you do. You do know the way. See, I'm the way. I'm the way. I'm the truth. I'm the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. But if you know me, you know the way. My Father, He cares so much for you that He sent me here to die for you. And He rose, raised me up from the dead. And this is the one I want to introduce you to, Jesus is saying. This is where I want to take you, to His home. This one who cares for you more than you can ever care for yourself. Now's the time. He says, now's the time. Father, thank you for Christ, for Jesus Christ. Father, thank you for caring for us so incredibly much. And Father, I ask you now, as we come to this season, this Passion Week, where we think on the death of Christ, we think on next Sunday, celebrating His resurrection, that you prepare us for this by letting us realize in our hearts, now's the time to follow Jesus. Now is the time for worship.